Hi, you are listening to Script Lock, where we talk storytelling in video games. I am Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Anna Kipnis and Ian Gill. Anna is a senior gameplay programmer at Double Fine and has worked on many games there, including Psychonauts, Brutal Legend, Broken Age, and Headlander. And she was the lead on Dear Leader during the last Amnesia Fortnite. Ian is a design director at E-Line Media and has worked on GameStar Mechanic, GameStar Mechanic Jr., and Never Alone. Thank you two for coming. Welcome.
Hi.
Hey.
So we will start out, as we always do, with how you two broke in. So Anna, would you like to start?
Sure. All right. Well, this is a difficult question because at the time when I was, I'm very old. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I'm not that old, but the problem was that when I knew that I wanted to work in games, there wasn't like a clear, this is what you do. You like get this kind of degree or you go to DigiPen or whatever. You know, there's so many programs for games now. At that time, I thought that the only people that could be working in games were programmers. And so I was like, okay, great. I'll just be a programmer. And I got a computer science degree. And it was just that there were no courses specific to game design or game programming even. Like there was just, it was very broad, you know, like it was a standard computer science degree. And so, and I also didn't intern anywhere, which was a mistake, but it made it quite difficult for me to actually get a job in games out of school. But there really weren't many, I don't think I knew a single game company in New Jersey, which is where I was at the time. Although Majesco, which is a publisher, but like they actually were there. So maybe if I didn't look hard enough, I don't know, hard to say. Also, the internet was very young at that time as well. So there wasn't like a whole lot of searching options that I could have made. But anyway, so I graduated in 2000, from Rutgers University. I have a computer science degree. And then I had this car that I had to pay off. So I actually got a job in web first, while I was still in school. And then the dot-com crash happened and they closed their office. So I was like, okay, great. This is the time. This is when I can do, you know, I can finally apply for all these jobs in games. And I sent out, I did all this research. I sent out my resume to pretty much every game company I'd ever heard of. Most of them, I never heard a reply. Some of them were kind enough to at least give me like this postcard. I remember Capcom sent me a little postcard like, thanks for applying. We don't want you, but we have you on file now. Thank you. Like, and that was it. And so I was like, oh, God damn it. But I had, I grew up with a lot of my friends really loved games and they went on to do press. Like they would write, you know, they started as freelancers. Eventually they were full-on journalists, and they were doing a pro. They knew that I was looking for a job in games as a programmer, and they had been doing a profile on Double Fine at the time. And they mentioned to Tim, "Hey, if you're looking for programmers, we have a friend, you know, who would like to work at a game company, especially at your game company, because it's really cool." And because you know, Psychonauts hadn't been out very long or anything like that, or in fact it hadn't been out at all, but they did have a really cool demo at E3 and it won all these, you know, awards. Like everyone's interest was piqued, and so my friend mentioned this to me and I went on the website and I like, and at the time Double Fine's website was like Tim's personal blog about the company essentially. Like he talked about all the sewage that was coming out of the toilets and how like they had a mouse and rat problem and like all kinds of great stuff to hear about a company that you want to work for. But actually kind of, I have a terrible phobia of rats, but I was like, oh my God, this place sounds so cool. I don't care about my rat, you know, phobia. Like I still want to work there. And so, like the minute my friend told me about, or basically like, you know, after doing my bit of research on the company, I knew Tim's games from before. Like I played Grim Fandango and had heard of like, you know, his other games. And Grim Fandango, I played with a friend of mine in college and it kind of blew me away. So I was like, oh my God, yeah, I want to work on this game with, you know, for this dude. And I sent my resume, and because I read through the website, I also sent like little peanut butter packets, like for the mouse traps that they had, because they figured out that nothing worked. Like cheese actually does not work, but peanut butter works great. Just a little tip if you have rat problems or whatever. But so I went to the store and I bought these little packets that would fit in like an envelope and stuff. And I sent them off and I wrote like the sassy cover letter. And then I did not hear back for like a week. I was like, oh, well, that's just like all the others, right? But then Tim emailed me and he's like, oh, hey, sorry. We had a milestone party and I shoved everything into my desk. So I just found that, hey, sorry, it took so long. So tell me about yourself. Oh, and by the way, we're not hiring or anything. Wow. I was like, oh, God damn it. All right. So but he grilled me for like a month over email, just asking me all kinds of questions, like, why do I want to work in games? Like, what are my ideas about games? Like, as in, you know, like design questions and opinions and just actual standard interview things. Because it actually, Tim has a computer science degree as well. And so there's a lot of, you know, at least the way that I saw it, I felt like I really had a lot. He's kind of like my somebody I looked up to because he had a computer science degree and he ended up being a game designer. And I was like, oh man, I really want that. And and he's also really fun to talk to. And so like, I would just stay up till like 6 a.m. Now I was on unemployment at this time and my parents would wake up to go to work and they're like, what are you doing with your life right now? Cause I'd be sitting there like still answering that email. But anyway, so this went on for a while and Tim, after some time ran out of questions and he's like, well, you know, we're not hiring, but if you're in town, we could at least like give you an interview or something. Like, I think it was just like kind of a, well, it's been good talking to you, phasing out, you know. So I was like, sweet, I'm going to do that. I'm unemployed. I have all, you know, I have money saved up. So I'm just, I booked a flight and I think this is a really long form version of the story because when I got there, I actually never made any official appointments with Double Fine. And I just ended up in San Francisco and I was like, what am I doing with my life? What, you know, like I remember thinking that, I was imposing somehow, I don't know, but it all kind of worked out and I had an interview and it was like a real interview and I did really well. Or, I mean, I think, you know, I managed to, like, you know, I'd been doing a lot of web stuff, which actually deals with a lot of like user facing stuff and interfaces and some design, a lot of implementing someone's ideas about how something should work. And there was a surprising amount of overlap and it was all like these really high end websites like Coke and, you know, British Airways and DirecTV and stuff. So anyway, so the interview went well, but they're like, well, you're great, but we can't hire you. We have no money to hire you. So I was like, oh man. Okay. So I went back and I think this was in July, the interview. And then in October, Tim called me to say like, hey, great news. We are getting money from Microsoft to hire people. And I'm sending an offer letter. And that's how I broke into the industry.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was not easy. And I certainly didn't make it easy for myself by, you know, just I had no real idea how to do it. And I feel like, you know, when you hear people talk about how they broke into the industry from that long ago, like a lot of people just kind of like stumbled into it any way they could, I guess, is the moral of that story. Let's hear from how Ian was a pro.
Yeah, well, actually, case in point that still happens these days. I'm a tiny baby and grew up in the era of, you know, the DigiPens and the, you know, all the school programs that are specifically for games and are feeders into the game industry. I didn't do any of that. I have a like philosophy and art degree, so you know that wasn't super helpful. And I actually came in to the industry actually at the company that I'm at right now. I was living in New Jersey at the time because I grew up there, and I was actually not doing anything relating to games at all. I had sort of taught myself how to do web design, and I also drew comics in kind of as a hobby, but I was sort of pursuing it. And a friend of a friend basically introduced me to this guy, Alan Gershenfeld, who's the president of Eline, the company I work for now. And at the time, they were actually not doing games. They were working in comics. And so there's no game connection there whatsoever. And that's why I got introduced, because I was interested in comics, and he was running a company that was involved in web comics and web comic platforms. So I ended up getting an internship with them, and this was like maybe 8 years ago or so. I was still in college, and I got an internship with them. There wasn't even an office at that point. We just sort of met at someone's house, and I left a pretty good impression, apparently. Because about 2 years later, when I was out of school, I got a friend of mine an internship at E-Line. I had gone back to school after my internship. I hadn't really kept up contact with the company, but we were, you know, connected on LinkedIn or whatever. And a friend of mine, who had also recently graduated, saw that I was connected to these people who work in games. And he was interested in games, so I got him... connected with them and got him an internship. A couple months later, he contacted me and said, "Hey, those guys you got me an internship with are asking after you because they're wondering like how you're doing." The office was in Manhattan, which is very easy for me to get to, and you know, you should just come in and say hi. So I went in. I had no expectations from this visit. I go in and. I see my friend and he shows me, you know, into the office, introduces me around the office to people. And at the time the company was maybe somewhere between, you know, 12, 15 people. And, we're walking around and the president and CEO of the company, come out of, you know, a breakout room or whatever. And they see me and they remember me from a couple years back and they're like, "Oh, Ian, what's up? What are you up to?" And I was like, "Well, I just graduated college, and right now I'm doing freelance web design." And they kind of look at each other for a moment, and they're like, "Well, we were just having a meeting about how we need a web designer. So do you want to have an interview right now?" So, you know, obviously I said yes. That went pretty well. I started working with them in a contract role. On a kind of online educational game that they had started working on called GameStar Mechanic, and as a web designer. And as that went on, I became more and more involved in the design side in terms of interface design and also aspects of game design. So some of the stuff that wound up in the game sort of later on in the game cycle were designs that I had created. So fast forward a couple of years, and I'm working on GameStar, and I'm working on other sort of internal projects. And on my like Google Calendar or whatever, there's a little... And my role at that point is sort of web developer and user experience designer. And on my sort of Google Calendar, I get a little alert that's like, "Hey, your boss has scheduled a meeting with you this afternoon." And so I turn to him because we're all in a big bullpen environment. And I say, "Hey, what's this meeting about?" And he says, "Don't worry about it," which is the worst thing you can say. So I go into this meeting and it's my immediate supervisor and the CEO of the company. And he says, "Hey, we're starting up this new project called..." And it didn't have a name at the time, actually. "But we're starting up this new project where we're working with a bunch of Alaska Native people. And we're going to be creating a game for consoles. And we're going to be starting up a new studio in Seattle to do it. Do you want to move to Seattle in 1 month and become a game designer?" And this was on a Friday, so I was like, "Can I have the weekend to think about this?" And they said, "You know, of course." But it's funny because I'm a person who can't decide what to eat for lunch every day. But in that meeting, right when they asked me that, I knew I was going to say yes. It was like a big decision, moving to a city that I'd never even been to before. I didn't know anyone there, no connections whatsoever. But for whatever reason, the decision was just immediately obvious. So I did. and now I live in Seattle, and I've been here for a few years. And I was a game designer on Never Alone, and I moved into being a lead designer and slash design director at the studio, and that's where I'm at now.
Wow.
It's awesome.
So it's just another case of kind of falling ass backwards into games.
Yeah.
And also through web, which is kind of interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And also from New Jersey.
Yeah.
So when you were at university, were you working towards working in games with like your philosophy degree? Or are you going towards something else?
No, not at all. I wasn't even thinking about games. Okay. I only kind of got back into games sort of towards the end of my time in university when I encountered some like indie developers and started, I kind of stopped paying attention to games for a while, sort of towards the end of high school and going into college. And for whatever reason, I'm not sure what it was, but I somehow stumbled into the weird world of indie games kind of pre-Braid or around that time. And that sort of started getting me back into it, but I didn't really know how I would work in games. Like, it was very opaque to me at the time.
And I haven't seen the title of design director before, but like, what roles do you have with that?
Design director is kind of a, at least for me at this company, we're not a big company. So design director is kind of a hybrid class kind of situation where I do a lot of kind of initial design on projects that we have. I help evaluate potential projects that we might do. I'm kind of where the buck stops for the design team. And I can act as a lead designer on specific projects or programs that we do. Also internally, this isn't really officially part of my job, but I help run game jams within the studio and am sort of trying to champion prototyping and just trying to make this sort of studio culture a more kind of creative and welcoming and just nice space to be. So it's kind of all over the place. Design is already a pretty all over the place field. And so being a design director just means you get pulled in even more directions.
How often do you have game jams?
Not too often. It's usually if we have some downtime between projects or if we're trying to kind of come up with ideas against a project that has come in. At Eline, we work on lots of weird stuff. So the two major titles that I worked on here of Never Alone and GameStar Mechanic are wildly different, right? One of them is this cultural game for consoles and PC and whatever. And the other is a kind of educational game for elementary and middle school kids about creating games and doing game design. If I wasn't under NDA about all the other projects that we have, you'd be amazed at the breadth and weirdness that there is here. So it's pretty all over the place.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting to hear like that you guys do game jams kind of in your off time. So Double Fine, we do Amnesia Fortnite, which many of you might know, I don't know. But we specifically do those or at least we started to do those while we were working on Brutal Legend, because we had been working on this game for about 3 years and we were getting really exhausted, I think, by it. Like not so much the, you know, the hours or something like that. It was more just the like a creative exhaustion. And we had rolled an engine from scratch, and it was kind of Tim's idea to just like, okay, forget what you've been working on and just try this thing, or like just try to make games. Like, let's see what other games we can make with this brand new engine we just rolled. And we were very skeptical at first, because it's like, oh God, we have to crunch for 2 weeks to make, like, you know, it's been taking us so long to make just like this other game. Like, are you kidding me? We're not going to accomplish anything in 2 weeks. We're just going to be so tired. And it was actually surprisingly the opposite, even though we did, I think, work a lot. It was actually invigorating creatively.
We had the same experience to some extent. I mean, the game jam internally came kind of from a different place, but it was also after nearly a year of, among other things, porting Never Alone to other platforms. By the time we're done, it will be on every platform under the sun. And as a process, is not the most exciting and fun thing in the world. We were also working on other projects, but those are all very like long-term, slow burn kinds of projects. And so the prospect of just making something in a couple weeks was so enticing and so kind of invigorating, and just kind of confidence building, you know, it's like, oh, right. Mm-hmm. We still know how to make a thing. Yeah. So that was very rewarding.
Yeah.
Just to backtrack a bit, because I like hearing from people who get into the industry and their majors are not like computer science or not programming related. Has your philosophy major helped out with your work at all?
I think so. I think it has actually helped immensely, despite the fact that I wasn't exactly a philosophy major. I went to NYU, specifically the Gallatin School at NYU, which is the school of individualized study, I think is what they call it, which means that you kind of make up your own major. Okay. So mine was not exactly... It was a weird... It wasn't like I double majored in art and philosophy. It was like a weird art-philosophy hybrid major. And I think it has actually helped me a lot. I know that sort of the big reward that I got out of higher education was not so much a deep dive into a particular subject, but it was the reward of finding connections between subjects and being able to be a bit of a dilettante and bounce around in different departments and having the freedom to explore meant that I could find fascinating connections between philosophical studies and linguistics and evolutionary biology and art that had I only been able to study in one of those fields, I would not have made those connections. And those kinds of insights, when you're reading, you know, a history book about the Arab people and something in it reminds you of a philosophical text about metaphor that you read the other week, that kind of connection and that kind of spark of insight is incredibly rewarding. And I think when it comes to games, and specifically being a designer in games, so much of what you end up doing is having to bridge crazy gaps between different subjects, but also people who think very differently. And so being able to kind of speak, I'm also self-taught with programming. And so like, I'm by no means an expert, but I have enough that I can sort of speak some of the language with engineers. And I also have some knowledge of art, so I can speak that language with artists. And having an educational background where you really think about the meaning behind creative decisions is incredibly important, I think, for a designer.
Actually, I want to echo some of that. Like, this is the biggest piece of advice that I give to students who are studying and are trying to break into games and are not sure what courses to take and stuff like that, which is that when I was – so I actually had three minors, and one of them was philosophy. And the other one was like cognitive science and psychology, because I was really interested. I wanted to do AI. First of all, like I thought that it was relevant to games, but I was also just really interested in that stuff. And my school also forced us to take electives, which turned out to be like the biggest, the most wonderful, I guess, like compulsory thing I've ever had to do, I think, is I ended up taking film classes, like a lot of film classes initially, because I was just trying to be like, oh great, this is a class where we would just watch movies all the time, right? So, but it turned out like it blew my mind. I remember I took this Japanese film class and I walked in like a couple of minutes late, and the professor, she was talking about Carl Jung and how when it is when a mother is holding an infant and they look in the mirror that for the first time the infant can separate itself from the mother. And like, just saw, I was like, am I in the, like, I started looking at like the room number. I'm like, wait, is this the film class? Like, what is going on right now? But she was talking about, you know, the film theory of why it is that the viewer identifies with the character so strongly, or the protagonist, or whoever it is that they identify with. And it is, that is very relevant to games. And I mean, it's very relevant to pretty much anything, like any art form that, you know, perhaps has this kind of like mirror neuron, or like, you know, this like when you identify with something in the piece of art. And it's like, I mean, that's, it was incredibly useful for me. Like, I remember when I was working on Psychonauts, actually, we actually did, all the gameplay programmers did the in-game cutscenes. Like the ones, like you can tell the difference between the Bink ones. They're like usually, unfortunately, lower quality now. And then the ones that render in game were the ones that the gameplay programmers actually put together. And then we had eventually an animator did go through just to make sure we weren't, you know, fucking everything up. But it's like those classes, like those electives, like first of all, kept me sane in school, because computer science, some of it can be a little bit dry, you know, and it was, I always like to take, I mean, of course there were some classes in computer science where they were as good as any film class or whatever that I might have taken. But then there were some others where I was just like, okay, this is great, but I would like some, like a cultural injection or something, I don't know, something where I just like, I'm not losing track of, what's going on in the world. And this is like, at school is like people's only, you know, finest opportunity to actually devote, you know, officially, and like they can be as serious about this one subject as they want to be, or like it's given this gravity that you simply don't have once you finish school. Like I continue to, like, you know, Ian and I talk a lot about linguistics and stuff like that. I listen to various lectures or read books or something like that. But it's not the same as just being completely like embroiled in it, having like a whole class that you can talk to about the stuff, or the professor, and having to write papers about it. There's something to that that you just won't ever get ever again in your life, unless you go back to school.
So now I'm going to switch gears a little bit with you, Anna, talk a little bit more about dialect systems.
Uh-huh.
So you gave a talk at GEC 2 years ago about them, and I saw in an interview that the reason you did that was because some indie developers had asked you about how much work was involved in doing voice dialogue in games.
Yeah, actually it was, so this is at Fantastic Fest in something like 2013 or so.
Yeah.
And it was the Kentucky Route Zero guys, and they were, you know, they were, I think, in the middle of development for the game, and they just had like some very general questions about how to tackle, you know, doing dialogue in the game. And I remember we were in the car, they were kind enough to drive, it was, you know, a couple of friends of ours as well, and I just started talking about it. We talked for an hour straight, or actually I talked for an hour straight, and I felt really bad, because all it was is just, it was like, it felt very one-sided. It was like they would ask me a question and I would like launch into an answer, and then they would ask me something else, and I just kept, and I realized like I could keep going for like hours about this. And I, you know, I like, maybe it would be useful if I gave, you know, a talk. Like I think I'd given a talk earlier that year in 2013 about Molly Jam. And it was just like, I really loved the Independent Game Summit. And I was just like, okay, I really want to do a talk for them about dialogue, because I bet you a lot of people would have dialogue in the game if it didn't seem like this scary subject, if they just kind of knew what they might run into. And so I submitted it to the IGS, and it was unfortunately turned down because, I guess they didn't know what to make of it, because it spans so many different disciplines. It was like everything from animation to audio to, I mean, generally it was about programming, but it was like, I was trying on purpose to make it as wide as possible, just because at indies, like, you have to do everything, right?
Yeah.
And I think they said that it was too hardcore and they didn't know how to describe it. So I was like, well, okay. And I was a little bit bummed out, because I think, well, I mean, I think it would have been a good talk, I guess, for the Indie Game Summit, but Then I was invited to speak at the Game Lab at NYU by Andy Neelan, and I prepared like a very short version of this talk. Like I think it was only 25 minutes long, but I got a lot in there, and it was pretty popular. And so I submitted, like, it was much easier to submit a talk once you have a video of a talk, it turns out. So GDC Europe accepted it, and then later regular GDC did. So that's kind of the story behind it. Yeah.
I know we can't talk about it for like an hour.
No.
Can you give like a brief thing about like what is involved with doing voice dialogue in games? Was there anything that the Kentucky Round Zero guys were super surprised to hear about?
I think the most common pitfall, and God knows we hit that on Psychonauts, is that you need to, the biggest struggle with dialogue is organizing it and making it flexible to changes. So basically, like, if you want to know just the very, very basics, like, you need to have a master list where you, like, that's, you don't hard code dialogue in your game, of course. You don't hard code WAV files in your game. You have like lines and some unique identifier for them, and you implement that unique identifier, and you figure out a way to export the data from this master list into something that your game can use. That's number one, because that leaves you, you know, if you only ever have text in your game, that'll work too. It doesn't matter. You just, you know, you don't have anything associated with like the waveform in your master list. If you do want to do voice dialogue, there's a couple of things, like you might want to consider doing lip sync animations, or, you know, a narrator who speaks off screen would, you know, obviously you wouldn't need that. So you, like, whenever you want to do voice dialogue, you have to think about it from the perspective of what's best for your game. It shouldn't be this tacked on thing. Like, you kind of want to play through your game and get a feel for where dialogue would really help the game. And because of how complex it is, and how much goes into it, you want to start thinking about it very early on. Sort of like, you know, the way you would develop kind of a gameplay mechanic. You know, what's right for your game is going to be different from what's right for, you know, someone else's game. And I give some examples of a flexible system that you could use and stuff if you really want those kinds of details.
When you gave your talks, what were the reactions you were getting from people? Were people super surprised, or were it just like, oh, that makes sense?
Generally what I was getting is like, oh, you know, if it's somebody who kind of had this, really thought it through and saw some of these same pitfalls and stuff, they were like, oh, well, yeah, I'm glad. It's good to hear a confirmation that I haven't, like, forgotten anything. And then some other people were like, oh, man, you just saved us a lot of time, because, like, we didn't realize that we needed to do this. And then there were some that were just like, I remember I gave the talk at GDC in America, which I had very different feedback versus Europe. So Europe, of course, localization is very, very important. And there are some, like, I had very specific even questions that were localization specific that you don't really get in the US. But in the US, I feel like they're, I don't know, for whatever reason, so a couple of the comments were like, yeah, well, this is all standard stuff. Everyone knows this. Which is funny, because the other 98% were like, oh, thank God I saw this talk. I mean, and that's great. You know, if you haven't learned anything new, then that means you're, you know, that's awesome. That means you guys have a really solid process, you know, at your company. But not everyone does. And I want to save people the trouble.
I saw the talk. I saw a version of that talk, at least. And, you know, I'd say my reaction was kind of, it was similar, actually. This GDC, I saw Jane Eng talk about many of the issues of working with a lot of people in a single scene in Unity. Mm-hmm. And my reaction to that was just sort of a, like, nodding my head and commiserating silently experience. And I had the same experience with your talk, Anna. We have Never Alone was translated into, I think, 17 languages. And wow. So we have an insane spreadsheet with all the text in the game, mm-hmm. that gets, you know, converted into JSON or something that gets pulled in. And every time I'm in that spreadsheet, I think of your talk, and I'm always really glad that we took that approach instead of something more kind of hard-coded or anything like that, because that would have just been, it's already insane, and going, had we made it any less sort of modular, that would have been much, much worse.
Yeah, yeah. We went through a terrible time on Psychonauts because we did have a lot of it hard-coded. I mean, a lot of us, so many of the people early on, at least at Double Fine, were from Lucas, and so they brought over some of these processes with them. But surprisingly, and maybe not so surprisingly, because there wasn't yet the fidelity in games went up tremendously, like around 2000, because you had consoles and you had full animations and you had lip sync and things like that. In the early days, even with voice dialogue, there was no requirement for that, right? So it was actually much easier to do voice dialogue back then. You could get away with a lot more.
Anna, what were some of the localization questions you got at GDC Europe?
So a really important one is how to account for like if you have an English writer or a writer in the language that has no gendered nouns or pronouns, or I mean, like, you know, you can say the he and she verbs don't conjugate based on the gender of the pronoun. In other languages they do, and also in other languages you have like a third gender, like in German and in Russian, you have a third gender, which is neuter. And anyway, it gets very, very complicated. So how do you account if you have an English language writer? How do you account for if you have even slightly dynamic dialogue? Like, for instance, on Costume Quest, you could be a girl or a boy, and then your brother or sister becomes the not chosen character, right? So how do you write dialogue for something like that with localization in mind?
How do you write it?
Well, the answer is basically you have to start thinking about that early. Like, you have to, like, at the moment that someone is writing it, you need to consider that you might be translating this into other languages. I'll give you another example. On the game Headlander that I'm working on right now, we have citizens. Everyone you can land your head at. I don't know if you guys know anything about Headlander, but you play as a head and you can land into bodies. And those bodies you actually are blowing away a citizen who had a name and they had, like, you know, a description for who they were or whatever. Well, those things are in English not conjugated. A citizen, you know, citizen Anna, citizen, you know, Ian or whatever, like those are, we can, they're both citizen. But in other languages, the word citizen gets conjugated. For, you know, based on whether it's male or female, and the word order might change. And so, for instance, like in this particular example, the way you solve that is you create a string with tokens in it. And those tokens can be, you know, in English, so the localizer typically get, because we start with English, so they get that that English string, and it's full of tokens. And they're able to move around those tokens in the sentence to wherever they think is appropriate for the language they're translating into. And then on the side of, like, you know, where you're trying to actually put together the text based on some, you know, you pick a name and you pick a, you know, what kind of citizen is it or whatever it is. And then you substitute those words into the string that has all the tokens, basically. It's kind of like that's one, you know, that's how you solve that particular problem. On Costume Quest, we had to have different lines for, you know, whether you've chosen, like, not every single line had to be that way, but on a couple of lines where it did become important, we had to have a system that allowed you to substitute lines and detect, you know, what the player had chosen and do the appropriate thing. Massive Chalice also had this. I actually don't know how they solved it, but it was something similar.
We solved it by never using he or she. It was all just based around using just the names of the characters, never referring to gender.
Well, there you go. So you know all about this.
Yeah. I feel so good figuring that out.
Yeah, oh, but you see, like, that's, you have to think about that pretty early on, or like as early as you realize that, oh my God, this is going to be translated into other languages. We got to do something. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely part of the writing process. And also, of course, whoever is implementing the dialogue or whatever it is, the text, needs to be aware, you know, that localization is going to be a thing. And you usually it's very smart to plan in advance for localization, just in case, just leave the door open, because, you know, it'll probably happen, at least, you know, these days.
Yeah, it was always in the back of our heads for the entire, it was, Brad reminded us the entire time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's good. So, Ian, and this will tie to you eventually, Anna, but, so with Never Alone, since the story is, and the cultural story is so tied with the gameplay, what was the back and forth like early on in development between, like, the writers and designers?
Well, on Never Alone, it was a complex process. So the way that Never Alone started was actually the director of the Cook Inlet Tribal Council in Alaska, the CEO of that organization, Gloria O'Neill, contacted Eline and had this idea basically to make a game about the culture of the Inupiaq people of northern Alaska. And the great thing about that was with her and her organization as a driving force behind the game, CITC has a lot of credibility in that region because they do a lot of sort of social services and outreach for that community. And so they know everybody, you know, and so they were able to get us in touch with all kinds of people, including the person who ended up being the writer for the game, Ishmael Hope, who is part Inupiaq, part Tlingit, and he was a, you know, as the writer, his voice really comes through in the game. There's a lot of back and forth in terms of the game design and misunderstandings and sort of cultural differences and different understandings of what, or different potential interpretations of what stories would mean. And so when the Eline team was doing research on stories, you know, the team found a whole bunch of different stories that seemed really interesting and really compelling as potential avenues to pursue. And when we showed them to Ishmael, he was like, ah, no. You've got all the wrong books. Let me send you the right ones. And so there were a lot of things like that where, whether it was the stories that we were talking about or even gameplay mechanics, you know, having a team that is a hybrid of Alaska Native people who come from this culture and this community and a bunch of people who don't and who aren't from that community, which is, you know, the a lot of the game development team is not Inupiaq, then you get sort of differences in understanding, and you have to sort of balance teaching developers about the culture and then also teaching people who are from the culture about development. And so it's kind of a mutual education process in order to make a game like this. And it can get touchy at times. You know, there are times when there are differences of opinion and you have to work out, like, how do we represent something well and how do we do that in a way that is authentic but still make a workable game with a workable design that allows players some flexibility and some freedom, because in the traditional stories, there is a certain way that you tell these stories and there's a certain way that they play out, and opening up too much of that to the player maybe makes for better gameplay, but then subverts the original meaning of the story. So there's definitely a constant conversation throughout the entire process, both with the people you're working directly with, like the writer, but also with just other people in the community who all have different opinions and who all come from different areas. The Inupiaq community, like any community, is not monolithic. And so there's all kinds of different opinions that you get, and you're never going to represent all of them perfectly. And sometimes you just have to make choices. And so certainly having an organization that could, like CITC, that could mediate this process was a huge boon and made the whole thing possible.
You mentioned that you threw away some mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of those?
So an example of that is, if you've played the game, you know that there are spirits in the game that sort of get revealed in the world. And these are sort of helping spirits that are drawn from Inupiaq, traditional Inupiaq stories and beliefs. And there are spirits that sort of exist in the environment. And there was an idea at one point to have a button, an action that the player does to kind of go into a spirit mode or spirit reveal that would conjure the spirits up, basically. That they would be in the environment, but that you would have to kind of like call them into being or reveal them. And having that as an explicit player action just didn't ring true to any of the people from the community that we were working with. And they were saying like, no, that's not how this works. Like, we get that you're coming at this from a sort of perspective where it's about what can the player do and what's the player's action. But these spirits are not here to do your bidding. They're not here. They don't just show up for you. And also, they're not in a separate parallel world or anything. They're in the world that we live in, and they can be helpful. They can help people who do good things. But just having a button to conjure them up and make them do stuff just didn't feel right to them. So that's an example of something that we tossed.
So there's a question for both of you. We'll start with Anna. So proper cultural expression is still pretty new to games, or at least developers making a big effort to include it. And like Anna, with Dear Leader, what were the issues and the problems that you were encountering with that game, since the Eastern Bloc's culture is so important to it?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Like, first of all, just in general, like, I think we're really used to playing like hero games, and I really wanted to make a tyrant game. Like, it's a game where that was like kind of exploring this other dynamic. You're not necessarily a good, like, you don't have the same scruples that a hero might. And in fact, it was more about, like, have you guys played that game, Netrunner?
No, but we know about it.
Okay, well, it's asynchronously played, and, you know, one side plays a hacker who's really typically, like, that's your RPG character. I don't know, it's very similar to just, having, like, a hero character. But the other player plays the corporation. And the corporation has some, I mean, they both have kind of evil tricks, but man, the corporation's really powerful. It can do a lot to, you know, fuck with the hacker. And I really love playing as a corporation because it's so different. Like, it feels like a brand new kind of play experience. Like, you start out, you're very like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, a really great moral corporation. I'm not going to do anything bad or whatever. And then the player attacks you, or, you know, your opponent attacks you, and you're like, who does this guy think he is? What the fuck? I'm gonna destroy him. And you get like a real sense of glee from like really like doing evil stuff in that game, which I just think is a really interesting thing that hasn't been explored much. So that's kind of one aspect that I wanted to have, and that has nothing to do with Eastern Bloc in particular. The other thing is I was really inspired by Papers, Please, which I was on the other side of that border control situation, you know, in my own life. I'm from the USSR originally. And to play a game where you suddenly see things from that, you know, you're still kind of a cog in the machine, but really you have this enormous power in that game. And it's like that game is very much about exploring, you know, what that means, like, and the ethical considerations, although that isn't how it originally, I think that game did come from the mechanics, which I thought was very interesting. And, Lucas Pope wanted you to do certain things, but he used story to get you to do them because some of them were really unethical, for instance. Anyway, and I played that game and I realized, like, well, you know, you're still a cog in the machine. I really think that a tyrant has a lot of pressures and things, like, they're not ultimately in control of everything either. And so I've read a lot about, you know, Stalin, and especially like from your criticism of the regime from the left rather than the right, like people who were against the USSR that were like Victor Serge, for instance, is a good example. Like he was somebody who was in the Communist Party and then he escaped or whatever. He was in exile for a long time and he didn't die the way that Trotsky did, of course. But you could argue that Trotsky, had wanted the power for himself, and that's why he was like so rambunctious about it. Victor Serge never really wanted that power for himself, and so I didn't want to be jingoistic about it, and so I did a lot of research to see, because my family ultimately left the USSR. I wanted to, and I knew that side of the story, but I wanted to see like how did it get so bad, basically. And so I did a lot of research, and there's early propaganda actually had a lot of really positive messages, like, please don't get hit by trains, be careful, because trains had just gotten installed and people just had no idea how to deal with that. Or like, educate yourself, and instead of drinking you should read a book or something. And they would always try to present it in a way that so illiterate people would understand where you're getting at and stuff. And like, there's a lot of women's rights stuff, like, oh mom, I wish you, if only you could help me with my math problems or something. And it's this kind of like old style farmer who's the mother. And I wanted to capture a lot of that, because I feel like when the Soviet Union lost the Cold War, Soviet culture kind of was rejected by Russians themselves and Americans because of the language problems and what gets lost in translation and stuff. And then also, once the Cold War ended, Russia kind of adopted a lot of the Western franchises because they were now very interested in making money and stuff, and they were looking to the West for inspiration for that. And so a lot of the culture that I grew up with was never really popular or like well known by anybody, really, I feel like. And I wanted to present it in a way that people saw it not from that Cold War lens where like all the names are really long and sound weird. Like I wanted them specifically, like people even on my team would ask me like, well, why these names don't sound Russian? I was like, yeah, they don't sound Russian because when you're Russian, they don't sound Russian. They sound normal. Right. Yeah. And so that's, I really wanted the player to feel like they were in that lost culture, I guess, like as much as I could, like, a lot of the reference and stuff that I would give the team, like, for instance, even just the music, you can actually turn on the radio in the game, or I shouldn't call it a game, it's just a prototype, but you can turn on the radio and you would hear all these Eastern Bloc composers, of the late 19th and early 20th century. And like it sets a certain mood. And I don't know, it was very important for me to make the player feel that this wasn't strange. It was going to be a novel experience, perhaps, but that they would never feel alienated in it. Like that they would kind of feel welcome in it, I suppose, even as a tyrant.
Yeah. Does that echo any of the challenges you had, Ian?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that there's a degree of needing to take something that is, in a way, interesting because it is different, because it is from a different culture, and make it accessible or create an experience that is relatable to a broader audience. And so in the same vein as having names that don't seem foreign to you because this is because it's a setting that you just want to be familiar with, there's a context for, in the case of Alaska Native stories, there's a context for those stories. There's a whole cultural context for them that you kind of lose when you're from anywhere else. And as an example, there are some stories about the Aurora, Aurora Borealis, that are kind of terrifying. And Ishmael told us these stories, and there's actually a video of him in the game recounting this story that his mother told him about how he was warned to not go outside with his hood down on his parka when the Aurora Borealis was out, because the Aurora is actually the spirits of dead children who are flying around in the sky. And if they see you walking around outside without your hood up on your parka, they'll think your head is a ball, and they'll swoop down and rip it off of your body and play soccer with it in the sky. And
wow,
which is kind of amazing, but it's something that if you don't have the aurora around as part of your sort of normal life, has kind of a different meaning. And so we actually got some feedback, some comments from people when we were showing it at PAX and online about how messed up it was that
tell us what you were showing. Was it like these things actually ripping your head off and playing soccer with it? Or?
No. It's much milder than that, actually. We don't graphically depict the your head being ripped off or anything, but there are these kind of sky creatures that come down from the aurora, and right, they are a threat to you. And we would tell this story to people at PAX, just at our booth, and people would also see the story in the game. And we would get some feedback that was like, oh, it's really messed up that they're taking this beautiful natural wonder, the aurora, and making a horror story out of it. And but it has more practical implications. And when you actually live up there, it gets unbelievably cold. And on clear nights when you can see the aurora, you've got to keep your hood up. You've got to stay warm. And so there are implications to and cultural context to stories like these that don't necessarily translate very well without kind of including this broader context. In the case of this story, it's still an interesting story, but having it be about something that is just part of your environment as opposed to some exotic thing you've only seen in National Geographic lends a very different kind of tone to it.
I can never not think about that from now on whenever I see an aurora borealis.
You can see where that superstition would come from, right? Because like you would, as a kid, it's such an amazing sight that you're just not paying attention. You're just staring at it for maybe hours, and you're like, in the meantime, getting really cold, and the hypothermia begins to set in, and that's that.
Yeah,
pretty much. And actually, interestingly enough, I was talking when I was recently in Scandinavia. I was talking with some people from the Sami community. The Sami are an indigenous people of northern Norway, Sweden, and Finland, and actually a bit of Western Russia as well. And so up there in the Arctic Circle, they obviously have the aurora as well, and they actually have very similar stories about it. So watch out.
Do they play a different sport with your head?
I actually don't know about the sport specifically, but the aurora is not something you wanna mess around with.
Awesome. Anna, I want to go back to dialect systems for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask you, what's the newest kind of dialect system that you've encountered in a game recently? And have innovations gotten more or less frequent these days when it comes to dialect systems?
Let me think about that. There's small little advances in dialogue systems all the time. I would say that the most interesting ones are the ones that have that use a lot of game state for, it's a little bit dynamic. I'm just trying to think of like what a recent game where I actually saw this. To be honest with you guys, I haven't had time to play games as much recently, or at least games with like, long story and dialogue.
Yeah, that's understandable.
When
was the last time you were impressed by one?
I was impressed by one. Well, so, I mean, I actually play a lot of board games, and board game implementations on iOS, none of which have dialogue in them. But let me think. I mean, of course, I should maybe mention Her Story because, well, I'll bring, since we've never done a podcast together before, and this is a very old game at this point, only a whole several years, but I really liked 80 Days. Yeah. In that it was this game that, if you read, I was really fascinated with the story, like Around the World in 80 Days when I was a kid. Like there were a lot of like Russians loved that story and stuff. And I remember just thinking like, oh, I would have totally gone a different route. They're making a mistake. Well, like here is your opportunity. This is such a well-written game. And here's your opportunity to essentially experience the game in that way. Like, it draws you into the story. There's, you know, a small, like, simulator, like, management aspect to it where you really have to, like, manage the money and what you're taking with you and the, you know, min-maxing your supplies and things like that, right? And it's just all these things that really draw you into the story. So it's like, I think it's really lovely how they managed to do that. And it's such an undertaking with writing, as you can imagine, guys. Nick and Max. Yeah. And then what else? So, and of course, I should mention her story, because that was also another interesting way of doing narrative. To me, like, what's interesting is not so much the dialogue system itself, but the way that it's used. I'm really excited by games that have that, like, kind of allow the player to take control of the narrative in a meaningful way. So, like, for instance, in 80 Days, like, the reason why I love it so much is because the way that I played the first time through is the way, like, you can just think that there are no other possible options, that this was perfect because it was well written and everything, that it felt like a full experience. And then I actually did play it again, and then I did a totally different trip, and it still felt really good, you know.
Yeah.
Ian actually recommended a game that I have a lot of trouble playing, but I really want to learn. But so far, I spent like 3 hours in it, and I'm barely just like understanding kind of the... It's Crusader Kings 2. I don't know if you guys have played it. It is an undertaking to learn that game, but it is very rewarding once you kind of get the hang of it. I will say that it took me about 2 hours to really grasp all of the things that I could do in the game and to start... to being aware of them in a way that was interesting for the actual game experience. I think I've only had like 1 hour of pleasurable game stuff, and then I had to fall asleep. And then I forgot how to play it the next time around, because it is very, the learning difficulty on that game is insane. But it's cool. What was
rewarding about
it for you? So like the way, and maybe Ian should pitch it to you, but the way he pitched it to me, that I was like, yes, I'm going to play this. It's basically Game of Thrones, the game.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're thinking a lot about the legacy that you leave behind, and it's all about these intrigues and stuff with other sovereigns and armies and controlling territory. But you do these, like, part of the game is doing these, like, story elements. A lot of it is really more about diplomacy. It's not so much like Risk style, moving your troops around or anything like that. Although that's interesting and that's there also. But, like, man, the intrigues that form, like, every single character has an opinion of you, and you have an opinion of them, and that's all, like, expressed in numbers. It's like the game is a massive UI form, essentially, where, like, you just look through data for hours and try to make sense of it, and then try to, like, make a move. I think that's the biggest problem with the game, is, like, you're faced with so much complexity that it's hard to know what to do, basically.
Yeah, I'd say an interesting thing about that game is, like, one of the most important decisions you make is who to marry, as opposed to, you know, how to invade a country or anything like that that you would expect from a sort of grand strategy game. It's like, who do I marry? Who do I marry my kids off to? What kinds of alliances will I get? How will I set up the order of succession? All of which could sound kind of boring, but the kinds of player stories that come out of it are amazing and insane. And you end up, in order to keep the kingdom together, this relates to, I think, Anna, your intent with Dear Leader. You maybe want to be a good king, but you are being threatened from all sides by other people and by holy wars and what have you. And just to keep things intact and to keep everything under control, and to keep your legacy intact, you have to sacrifice a lot, and you may end up assassinating your relatives as a part of that, and excommunicating your wife, and you know, just things that are truly awful, but also fascinating. I mean, they're fascinating kind of gameplay choices that you have to make, and because you're playing in medieval Europe, you're also thinking about, like, what this means and what your historical legacy is. And I think there's certain points at which that really gets driven home, where your character, you know, playing as a king, will get a nickname that is just given to you. You don't get to pick it. And so you're playing as a character, you know, as King Alfonso, and you become known as King Alfonso the Lionheart, or the Courageous, or the Cruel, or the Weak. And it's just the game sort of giving you feedback as to how you will go down in history. And there are times where I would play as a character, as a king, who did all these terrible things, and my heir was going to be this, you know, weak idiot or whatever, and so I sent him off to war, fully intending for him to never come home, and I excommunicated my wife and did, you know, other terrible stuff, and yet I get known as, you know, King So-and-so the Kind. And and there's just a part of me that's just like, aha, gotcha. You know, like, there's a secret history here that no one will ever know.
Yeah, there's actually, you just reminded me of something that, in fact, so I can say this because I didn't work on that game, even if some of my code from older games shipped with it, but Massive Chalice, I had a similar experience where you guys wrote a lot of these, like, these random events in it. The whole game was about legacy, like a 300, like, you really, when you first start playing, I remember I kept dying early on, and I found it so frustrating. And then when I finally realized that I should just embrace it, the game became it became amazing, because it's like it's not about the individual heroes; they all die. You have to survive for 300 years. Most of your dudes will only live, like, you know, they'll serve you for like 20 years or something like that. And there's something that happened was I had this guy who was actually the Kipnis family. And he was an old man, but he was like one of my best warriors, but he was really about to die. And I just, you know, this random event came up about throwing him into the chalice, which I think you often do. And I was like, yeah, fuck it. I'll throw him into the chalice. You know, he did well for me. Maybe he'll, like, you know, surprise me one last time. But if he doesn't, you know, it'll be kind of an interesting memory to live with. Anyway, and what had happened earlier in that game is that you get one relic when you start. And the relic is this really important weapon that makes your army so strong. And I lost it immediately. Like, and the way you lose it is the only member of that family ever is killed. And that's it. No one else can equip it. And I was relicless and I was about to lose. And then when all of a sudden this old grandpa comes back out of the chalice with a really powerful relic. And it so happened that the Kipnis family was just like the only one in the land that was taking over everything. And that, maybe that wasn't the case yet, but that's what happened, is the Kipnis family survived everyone because they had this one relic and it kept getting passed down. And I was like really invested in, like, oh God, I got a relic again. I better make sure that these guys all live. And it's just like, it felt so special, like that one moment in the game, because of how it, you know, it was a narrative. It was a very small little narrative thing that had such an impact on my experience as a player, that told, like, that overall story of those 300 years. That was the single most important event. And I thought that was so cool. And that's actually, like, more than dialogue systems, the nitty gritty of them, like, that's what excites me about doing something interesting with a dialogue system, because you could just have, like, random, you know, like, lots of games use dialogue systems like that are really, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, really, complex and sophisticated, but they don't use them in interesting ways. And I think it's more important to use them in interesting ways than it is to have something really complex.
Oh, that's also the ideal way we want people to experience that story. It's like, oh, that's fantastic. And I have a somewhat related question to what you were just talking about complex dialogue and systems, and it's for both of you now. The more dynamic the dialogue is in a game, the more difficult it becomes to have fully voiced characters because of how long and expensive recording sessions would be, and subtitles and lip syncing, etc. Is this a problem we'll ever be able to solve, and is text-to-speech the future?
I will start by answering that text-to-speech is maybe not the future yet, or won't be for a while. And I say this because Tim really hates text-to-speech. Like, we have an automatic, like, you know, when new dialect goes into our, like, master list, I just auto-generated, like, all the lines as text-to-speech, and Tim hates it. And the reason he hates it is because text-to-speech just cannot deliver lines as well as a human can. And they won't for a long time.
Yeah.
And the reasons for that are, you know, why do we respond to actors who are really good versus actors who are just merely okay? Because the people who can deliver a line well, there's so much complexity going on with that the computer, like, it's just not even in the interest of people developing good text to speech systems for doing dialogue well. Now, I can envision a system for text to speech that maybe has a lot of control. Like, you still have to have a person, of course, actually record the text-to-speech stuff, but maybe you can account for different emotions, and maybe there could be, like, a scripting language that defines, like, how these particular phonemes are, you know, what set of emotional deliveries to use for them. But even that is still not going to be as good, because now you're, it's sort of like, you know, designing how well something could be said and thinking really deeply about it. But a good actor just has that automatically, and they have, like, they're really connected with, like, the different ways in which you can deliver a line. You know, like, an actor can give you so much more depth and also breadth. Like, they can, a single line can be delivered a whole number of ways, and maybe you didn't even know that it could be done that way until an actor spoke it to you.
So what about the first question then?
I think that I think indies have more power in this than they realize, because there are a lot of struggling actors who are actually quite good, who haven't been discovered yet. Like, they haven't paid their union dues, or because they can't afford them, or, like, you know, they don't have an agent yet. There's, like, so many resources you can just, like, for instance, the way that Davey Reardon, like, when he found the actor for Stanley Parable, who's incredible, you know, it was just someone sent them an audition or something like that. It was off of some website, and it just happened to be amazing and exactly what he wanted. And then he worked very closely with him, and it was, like, done almost entirely over the internet or something like that, where he would just get a delivery of those lines. Yeah. Now, if you had that kind of situation where you could work, you know, you're not paying for hours and hours for studio time. Maybe the actor has, like, some kind of setup at home. Like, maybe you don't need, like, the thousands of dollars an hour studio quality recording. You can get away with doing a lot of stuff more cheaply. However, the complexity of actually writing dynamic dialogue and thinking really deeply about it and how you're going to put it together and stuff is just, like, it's an authoring challenge, you know? Yeah. And unless you don't want to have artistic control over that, I think you're going to have to do the work. I don't know.
Ian, do you have anything to add to either of those questions?
I guess a little bit, like, on the question of more dynamic dialogue and more to voice. I mean, one issue that a lot of games have with voiced dynamic dialogue is that you get these, you see the seams, or you hear the seams, rather, between different bits of dialogue, and so you can tell that dialogue is being spliced together, and that's a difficult problem if you are splicing dialogue together. If you're just recording entire lines separately, then you're ending up with a whole lot of time and a whole lot of data that you're having to hold on to. I guess, you know, in terms of recording, I agree with Anna that there are people who have not been discovered, and there are people who have great setups and sort of home recording studios. And so, just like game development itself, it's probably cheaper than ever, and more varied and versatile than ever to record this stuff. But that said, it still has the same scale problems that it has had traditionally, where a lot of dialogue is a lot of recording, and that's a lot to go through, and that's a lot of time spent. So, yeah, I wouldn't say I really have an answer to it, but yeah.
Yeah. Switching gears, for both of you, we'll start with you, Ian. What are your thoughts on
authored versus simulationist versus player-centric approaches to story or communication in games?
Well, so I realize this is something that we talked a little bit about before, and I guess what we're talking about when we talk about authored versus more simulation-oriented approaches to story are, you know, stories that are about, or it depends on what kind of story you're trying to tell. If it's a story in your head that you're just trying to communicate, or if it's a story about how a world works and the player uncovers the story instead of being told the story, or if you're more interested in the stories that players create for themselves out of the game, and, you know, tell each other and post online and sort of commiserate about. I think simulation and sort of the intersection of simulation and story is really interesting, and trying to find in a game what is meaningful to simulate. I know Tarn Adams, the creator of Dwarf Fortress, talks about simulating what he calls the narratively interesting parts of a world. And that is that you can't simulate everything about a world. I mean, the world that we live in produces all the stories that we know, of course. So how do you distill that and just find the parts that produce interesting stories? And what is that sort of editorial process? And what's the engineering process? And I would argue that it's also a writing process. It's also trying to work out what kinds of systems create the kinds of stories that you want to tell, or that you want players to tell each other, or that you want to get out of a system. In particular, I think one of the things that I was thinking about in regard to simulation is, and that I think is kind of interesting, is that we think about games as worlds, and worlds that you jump into, and you go into this world and you experience it, and you have sort of a direct connection to what's going on in this world, and you get stories out of that world. But a lot of games, the more you work on games, the more you kind of come to understand, I think, how much artifice there is and how much is kind of faked in games, and how much is sort of simplified and obscured. And I think where we think of, and this is getting into some stuff, actually, Anna, that you talked about in some recent talks, I think at Practice at NYU, yeah. We tend to think of a world, like a landscape, as having a certain kind of relationship to, like, representations of that landscape. And we think of a landscape or a world coming first, and then you draw a map of it. And the map is referring to the things that actually exist in this world. But I think games actually kind of work in the opposite direction. I think what you're creating in a game is basically a map that doesn't refer to anything tangible. There's nothing more to the game other than this map that you're presenting to the player. And the player constructs a landscape in their heads based on this map that you're giving them. And so what you're trying to say about a world is not just what's in the game. It's not just this map that you're drawing, but it's actually the experience of the player looking at the map and interpolating and interpreting and seeing, oh, these little symbols, these little upside down V's, those are mountains, and I can imagine that it's cold and frigid at the top of them. And so what exists in the player's mind and the kinds of stories that come out of the player's mind involves a lot of that kind of interpolation and extrapolation, where they're taking the points that you put explicitly in the game and they're working out what exists, or they're inventing even what exists in between them and beyond them. And that's kind of what is so rich and amazing about the kinds of stories you can tell in games, I think, is that you can imply so much.
Yeah, that's really beautifully said, Ian. That's kind of in part why lower fidelity games where every single possible detail is not clear, or like, you know, is not clear, but it's not readily apparent, you know, like with extremely high fidelity games like the recent AAA titles and things like that, to still leave things up to a player's imagination and to not like to not set their expectations that they can do, since everything looks so realistic, to not set the expectation that they can do everything in that world that they can in the real world is really difficult. And in fact, like leaving a little bit more to the imagination usually serves a story better. I want to come at this question from like kind of a different side, if you guys don't mind.
Great.
That
awesome.
My sort of take on that is when I encounter a game that's entirely procedural or it's you know relies very much on like there's you know it has no real how should I put this like you can clearly tell that whatever you're currently playing or experiencing was not painstakingly made by a person. If you can really tell that, I feel like the game is a little cold. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, like one of the things about one of my favorite games was, you know, whatever, Super Mario Brothers, the very first one. I know it's a very pedestrian sort of thing to bring up, but the fact that when you first encounter like those blocks and you hit one of the blocks and a mushroom comes out in a particular direction, and then it teaches you certain things about like, oh, and now I can break bricks now that I'm big. Like that's one of the first, like that is brilliant design, and it was painstakingly made by a human. Like someone sat down and they really thought about this, and it was like it was presented to you. Do you know what I mean? Like if that had been like a heuristic, like maybe they tried it once, but that's not what you played. What you played was a result of their like, you know, extrapolation from like taking some simple example, and then they extrapolated it onto like all of these different examples that they could generate for you. That to me is no longer as intimate, or it's like the human storytelling aspect of it. It's like now being left entirely up to literally randomness and chance in the game, with maybe some settings that were done by a human, but it feels a little bit cold. And the more you go towards procedural stuff, the more it feels that way. One of the things that's weird in Crusader Kings 2 is like there are these occasional moments of like amazing things that happen. I would argue that those things are like deliberate, actually. Like for instance, the fact that you get a nickname as being interesting and significant is a deliberate mm-hmm. like feature in the game. But there a lot of the AI, like they try to do really intriguing things, and a lot of them are just bland, and there aren't like these like peaks and valleys that you have in stories that make them compelling, right? And so the way that I see dynamic stuff working is essentially a combination of authored and simulated or like procedural stuff, so that the procedural stuff comes from like certain player decisions. They inform the system how the player kind of wants, what the player wants to try, like kind of the connections that they're making. And in as much as possible, the procedural part of the game then goes and reorders the authored content in a way that makes the player feel like they're making real like changes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd say also that the way I agree with you, Anna, that the, there are so many games that I've seen that have this kind of dead feeling to them because they are so reliant on procedural generation and they don't kind of have a human touch. And so you just kind of get these empty expanses that don't really feel like they're meant for a person to be in. But I think that's less a product of reliance on procedural generation and more about a lack of craft in the design of that procedural generation. I think that there are, like, as a kind of counter example, spelunking in Minecraft, like digging into caves and stuff like that, I was always amazed that those caves were not hand built by somebody because of mm-hmm. the sort of rhythm and tension that I could get out of them.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, like, so there are definitely times when you, I mean, but I see in part, like, the success of something like Minecraft was because there was a lot of thought put into the kind of the narrative element. Like, the very fact that the game starts out with, like, sort of a narrative scenario, I think, you know, where you have to protect yourself at night, the monsters come or whatever, I think says a lot. Like, it sets a stage for that, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I think it was something that was kind of, I mean, I can't, I don't know personally, like, what the process behind that was, but I feel like whether it was accidental or not, there is kind of a narrative drive in the game. And then there was a lot of, like, the sense of wonder of exploring and things like that was just really well executed. If you, you know, for, in terms of narrative and storytelling specifically, I think you do have to, like, there was a really excellent talk, if anybody has access to the vault, that Kent Hudson gives about the novelist and how he dealt with, like, a lot of this, like, sort of simulation soup, a lot of, like, these kind of very bland experiences that you can end up with if you're trying to, like, simulate story stuff procedurally. There's some really cool ways that you can basically direct the experience where you can still have these procedural elements that, of course, come from authored modular content, but you can put them together in a way that actually has, like, a lot of the feeling of climax of a story, or, like, you know, the build up and then, like, a resolution. Like, you just have to be, I feel like, aware that if you're doing a narrative game, that those things are important.
Do you think the more procedural kind of storytelling will become more prevalent now as people become more aware of how to, like, not make it bland anymore and know the tricks of solving it?
Yes, I think so. I think for sure. And I hope that it's not just, like, this one formula. Someone figures out, like, the 3X structure and go, and, like, that's all we're ever going to have. Like, I think, like, there's so much, like, this is, like, the most exciting field, I feel like, in games for me, is that dynamic storytelling. Like, any experiments with it at all are so interesting to me, because, like, you can do so much stuff, and I feel like we haven't even scratched the surface. We barely scratched the surface.
Yeah,
I agree. I mean, I think I've been playing some Stardew Valley recently, which I don't know if you guys have played it, but it's a kind of Harvest Moon / Animal Crossing sort of game.
What is it called?
Stardew Valley.
Oh man, I'm gonna check it out.
And it's huge on Steam right now, and it's such a delight in some ways. And part of what's fascinating about it is there's this town that has a bunch of inhabitants, maybe around 20, and you kind of get to know them over time. And every day you go into town and you talk with a shopkeeper and you interact with people in town, and some of them are single, and you can, and you can give people gifts, and you can talk with them and find out what they're interested in and what they like, and kind of become friends with them. And it's interesting because it's a very minimal system in some ways. With people, you generally have, like, a small snippet of dialogue that you can have with them each day, and sometimes it repeats. And once you've talked to someone, you just can't talk to them again that day, unless you, like, give them a gift or something or do some other kind of action. And it's a sort of, like, a 16-bit style game. And so it has this, like, level of fidelity that is low enough that you don't expect to be able to have really in-depth conversations with these characters. And so sort of the level of interaction that you can have with them is on par with the presentation style. Mm-hmm. But it also opens up this really interesting space, I think, where you do feel like you have a relationship to this community. I was actually surprised at how quickly that sort of took hold for me, and how actually I started to get attached to it. And I think that's something that people have historically in games overlooked or kind of gone the wrong path to try and pursue this sort of narrative depth or connection to character. And I think actually indie games have been showing another path where you can take a more minimal approach and actually have it be much more effective. Because, as you said, Anna, like if you have a game that looks photorealistic, but the characters don't have the kind of depth that you would expect from a real person, or the kinds of actions you can do are not as involved as the ones that you can do in real life, if there's that disconnect between the way things are depicted or rendered as being really high fidelity, but then your actual interactions are really low fidelity, then there's just this cognitive disconnect. And
right.
with a game like Stardew Valley or even Minecraft or whatever, I feel like because you, what happens when you lower the sort of visual fidelity of the game to certain levels, you free yourself up from having to match that visual fidelity with an incredibly complex level of gameplay. And you also actually open up that space for the player to fill in all the gaps and to create these personal connections to things that are purely in their own minds and purely of their own invention.
Right, right. Yeah, I have the same or similar experience playing that game Seven Grand Steps. I think I mentioned it to you before, Ian, too. Basically, that game is, it represents kind of life decisions in a very abstract, like, you know, you invest in the child by literally kind of dropping a coin into the child's, like, the slot representing the child. Mm-hmm. And things of that nature. And because it's so abstract, it lets you kind of fill in the gaps in like a really beautiful way. If anybody's interested in trying a game like that, Seven Grand Steps is really, really cool. I said that's one that I keep replaying over and over. And it's like a very, like, it's sort of a weird, like, it pretends to be a mechanical game, like kind of like one of those carnival things, like the fortune teller style. I don't know. If you guys know. But yeah, it's really interesting for those exact reasons that you mentioned. Yeah, and it can, like, even just reducing fidelity and trying to have all of your affordances be about narrative, like, is already, like, it's probably going to be something interesting.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, please do.
All right, this is a question that we didn't ask you or send you beforehand, but we like hearing what people say to this. And so for both of you, if you had to recommend a book to people in game development that they should read, but it isn't about game development, what would you recommend?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I would say The Codex Serafinianus, which is by the artist Luigi Serafini. And it is, by the way, he's still alive, which is crazy if you actually see what the book looks like. You can probably just search for it online if you're curious. But it is, and I mean, I suppose you should also read Borges Ficcionis, which gives you some context for what the Codex is, which is a fake encyclopedia of a world that doesn't exist. And it is like hundreds of pages, and it is elaborately illustrated and labeled. And it's like, it's basically like a biology book in an alien language. That I'll tell you, like, so basically the script, everything in it is written in a script that Luigi Serafini had come up with himself, and it's based on the Voynich script. But I heard that if you actually get him to sign your book, he'll sign it in that script.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing. But the reason why I would recommend it is because it just, like, you know, paging through it is kind of this... It's you get the sense that this book is magical in some way, and that the man who made it knew about the magic of books in the way that kind of I've only ever heard Borges talk about. And like that sense of wonder and playfulness that like it's at once kind of profound and also absurd is like that's my favorite thing in the world. It's something that like that playfulness and like coming from that place of trying to make something like magical and surprising and unexpected is that's kind of when I'm trying to come up with a game. That's the place that I'm trying to summon within myself. And I think that book is just like the closest that I can imagine of actually just giving it to somebody. And I feel like if you just look at that book, you will know exactly what I mean.
Oh, that's perfect. That's a good answer.
Yeah.
Ian, do you have an answer?
Oh, it's hard to follow.
Beat that, Ian.
Well, as soon as you started talking about the Codex, I was like, oh, I could talk about Borges, but then you started talking about Borges, so...
Yep.
That's okay. I mean, I think actually, I just to follow up on that, I think Borges is actually just invaluable, and the way that he approaches the subjects that he talks about are, he kind of just reveals the sort of delight and magic behind creation in a way, like the creative act, and for him it's you certainly get a sense of wonder in writing and in literature, but also a sort of fascinating take on the way in which you see the world, the way in which you understand the world, is just one of so many ways in which the world you live in can be interpreted. But not to stick on Borges, I thought of a different one, and it's Viriconium by M. John Harrison. And it's a collection of stories, actually, about a fictional city, Viriconium. And I think the interesting thing about it in particular is that it's a fantasy book, ostensibly, but it throws out world building in a very particular way. And in each of the stories about this city, there are contradictions with the other stories. And so it sort of the thing that you expect from so much of fantasy is to find adherence to a canon of some sort. And I think actually Harrison, the writer of this book, and George Martin, the author of Game of Thrones, are basically on exact opposite ends of this spectrum, where George Martin is all about kind of world building and the consistency of this world. And I think for his books and for his world, that actually works quite well. That's what he's talking about. But I would say that for Harrison, he's much more interested in kind of the disconnects and kind of the gaps between your understanding of this world in a reading of one story and then the gaps that come out of the contradictions that come from another story. And so as you're reading these stories, you find that some things happen in one of these stories, and then those things are referenced in another story, but in such a way that you know is not correct because you read about it in the first story. And so the way that it played out had to be different from how it reads in the later story. And so it's this interesting approach to talking about a place that it's kind of like Invisible Cities, the Calvino book that I think you mentioned before,
yeah,
where you get all these different stories about a city that seem contradictory, and yet you also get the sense that they really are all about a place and all about a city. Mm. And they're not getting caught up in the little details of exactly where a certain district is relative to another district, or you know, what is the cost of a spice at a certain time of year or anything like that. It's much more about sort of what serves the story at that moment and what sort of gives the right impression, even if those things don't line up with each other. And I think the quote from Harrison is that he refers to world building as, the clomping foot of nerdism. And I'm not quite so scathing in my evaluation of world building, but I think so much of what we do in games, we're so informed by certain kinds of tradition, in particular Tolkien as an example, and all of the fantasy writers that followed him, and certain kinds of, you know, hard sci-fi writers that are all about consistency. I think there's a certain take on the world and on storytelling that is informed by certain approaches to canon, and thinking about things as, oh, is this canon or non-canon or what, that we lose sight of some of the things that literature and storytelling has to offer in terms of ambiguity and the reader's own interpretation and filling in gaps with their own knowledge and their own understanding, and what that can really bring to stories and storytelling.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'll have to check out that book. I haven't read it.
Those are both really good answers.
Ian, what would a game that exemplifies that be to you? Like, anything that comes to mind?
A game that exemplifies that.
Yeah.
This is kind of why I'm recommending it, because I don't think there are many games that do exemplify this. I think actually I do have one that gets at it maybe a little bit. This is a bit of a weird one, but The Yogg. If you're familiar with that. It's a delightful party game, and it's for listeners who haven't heard of it, it's a game in which you play with other people and you're in a city that, unbeknownst to the inhabitants of the city, is going to be set upon by a disaster that is called the Yogg. And you're not told what the disaster is, what the nature of it is, why it's happening, why this city is doomed to encounter it. And you are left, you and the other people you're playing with, are kind of left to just go about your days in the week leading up to this event. And the ways you can approach it are you can either just sort of get trashed at the bar, or you can try and do as much good as you can, or you can try and improve your skills, or you can just try and go on adventures. And it's kind of up to you whether you think that your characters are even aware of this. And you can imagine these characters just drinking their days away because they're expecting this doom. Or you can imagine them sort of living their lives in blissful ignorance, whereas you, the player, know what's coming. And I think there's kind of a delightful ambiguity that game creates, and a fun space to explore, especially with friends.
That's really fascinating. I got to read the original book, though, first to like really understand what you're getting at.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On that note, where can people find you two on the internet?
You can find me at Double Anna on Twitter. And I don't use my Facebook very much, so don't worry about that. probably Double Anna is probably the best place.
Ian?
For me, it's Ian Gill on Twitter, just IANGIL, real simple. And I'm also garbage at Facebook, so just Twitter's fine.
And you can find our garbage Twitter account at ScriptLockCast on Twitter. And thank you two again for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for everyone who's listening to a 2-hour thing. Maybe it won't be that long, but
that's how long it is right now.
Yeah, thanks so much. Guys. This was wonderful. A lot of fun.